Red Ice Radio. This is Henrik Palmgren. Thank you for stopping by. We have Lloyd Pye back with us on the program today. He is the caretaker of the Star Child skull. He joins us for an update on what is believed to be the skull of a human-alien hybrid. And the question, of course, is this the first physical evidence of ET and hominoid genetic tampering? There have been some new developments since we last talked with Lloyd. You might have heard the news that nuclear DNA now finally have been recovered from the skull. Don't forget to go into our archive and check out our previous programs with Lloyd for the full background story. But Lloyd has some new exciting information to share with us about it today. His website is lloydpye.com, but also go to starchildproject.com for the main site about the skull itself. Welcome back to Red Ice Radio, Lloyd. It's great to have you back on the program again.
Great to be back, guys, and thank you for having me on again. I always enjoy it.
So tell us about the latest developments. What has been going on? I think that our listeners and those who follow our website have followed the news as well, the fact that you guys have been able to recover some of the nuclear DNA. But what does that mean for people who have no clue of what we're talking about here, Lloyd?
Well, first of all, let's make clear what the Star Child is for those few who might be listening who don't even know that. The Star Child skull is a real, true bone skull, no question about it, that has human-like characteristics, human-like shape, just a kind of a humanish look to it. But its parts are really, when you get down to it physiologically, it's not really human at all. It everything about its fundamental major portions are not human. So it's something that we've been working on for 11 years now, trying to get technology that was capable of proving what we suspected about the skull, that some part of it is not human, to prove that beyond all scientific doubt. And the only way to do that was with DNA. So in 2003, we had a DNA test that was our first attempt to crack the genetic code of the Star Child. Now, people need to understand that there are two forms of DNA that you can test. There's mitochondrial DNA and there's nuclear DNA. The mitochondrial DNA floats in little capsules within the cytoplasm of our cells. The cells in our bodies have the cell wall. Then they have the cytoplasm wrapped around a nucleus. Imagine just an egg. The nucleus is the yolk of the egg, and the cytoplasm is the white part of the egg. And floating around in there are little chips of nucleotides, which are called base pairs. And they're about 16,000 base pairs long. 16,000 base pairs long, each of these little mitochondrial particles floating around. Inside the nucleus, though, inside the yolk, is all of a being's nuclear DNA, what comes from both their parents. That's all 23 chromosomes from the mother and all 23 chromosomes from the father. All 3 billion base pairs are in the yolk. So imagine, get the numbers clear in your mind, 3 billion combined in the yolk, in the nucleus, 16,000 floating around in each of the many mitochondria that float in the cytoplasm. So in 2003, when they attempted to recover the mitochondrial DNA, it was a very easy recovery. The Star Child's DNA is very fresh because it was buried in a mine tunnel for 900 years. So it wasn't degraded by weather or sun, water, any of that. So it's really very well-preserved DNA, even for 900 years. So in the first run, they recovered the mitochondrial DNA, and that meant that it had a human mother because, and this is key, the mitochondrial DNA comes only from the female line. It passes down only from females, from mother, grandmother, great-grandmother, right on back as far as you care to go. This female line's mitochondrial DNA that all men carry and all women carry. But in the nucleus, again, as I said earlier, that comes from the mother and the father. So right away we knew that the Star Child had a human mother. So that was this equation right there in 2003. And the geneticist said, well, now if we get a good clear recovery like we got for the nuclear DNA, then that means it had a human mother and a human father, and you're looking at a deformity no matter what you think. So I said, okay, fire away. So they went after it, and they tried six times, and got no recovery. So once we had the mitochondrial DNA, and we knew that the mother was human, it was time to check for the nuclear DNA. And they said, you know, now that we know the mother's human, if we get a recovery here, it's going to mean that a human mother and a human father produced this being, and it's a deformity no matter what the differences in the physiology say. And I said, okay, fine. We just want to get this over with, and we want to know the answer one way or the other. So they started testing for the nuclear DNA. And to their surprise, in 6 attempts, they were unable to recover any nuclear DNA. And so what that meant very clearly was that the father was not entirely human. But in 203, there was no way to say what he was. There was no way to prove what he might be. All we could say at that point is, we know he's not entirely human. But what science, the attitude they took is, you can't say this means that we have a non-human father here. Mm-hmm. All this means is that your geneticist could not recover the nuclear DNA. And what that says to us is, using Occam's razor, the simplest explanation, is your DNA is degraded in some unusual way that doesn't allow the primers to pick it up. That's the attitude that science took. So while we all knew pretty much what it was, we had to play the game within the extremely restrictive rules of mainstream science, because they don't let anything in. You know the old saying, extraordinary claims require extraordinary proof. Mm. Well, we have one of the most extraordinary claims that you can make. And so we have to have proof of a level that is extraordinary beyond normal proof.
Yes.
So we were just stuck. And so I asked the geneticist, what can we do? And they said, well, you're going to have to wait 3 to 5 years for a technology to come along that will allow for the recovery of the entire genome, all 3 billion base pairs, because all we have are these primers, which are several hundred to a few thousand base pairs long out of the 3 billion. In other words, the primers that were used to recover in 2003 were relatively small. So if technology would come along that would allow the recovery of the entire genome, then we could lay that down against the entire human genome, the entire chimp genome, gorilla genome, and soon Neanderthal genome. And we'll be able to say exactly, specifically, what percentage the star child was away from normal. Now, understand that the chimp is 97% the same as us. Its whole genome, 97% the same. Only 3% separates us from a chimp. Mm. 5% separate us from a gorilla. So we were expecting the star child to be somewhere in that range. Even if it was 1%, that would be significant, because humans are all like, we're all 99.99% the same.
Right.
We're very, very much alike genetically. So if it was, the star child proved to be 99%, that would be a strong indication that it was alien or half alien, probably part alien. If it was 98%, let's say, then that would be a clear indication it was well away from human. 97% would make it equal with chimp. 95% would make it equal with gorilla. So we were hoping, I was anticipating, that we would move out to the level of chimp and gorilla, simply because the physiology of the star child, its physical structure, is as different from human as is the physical structure of a chimp or a gorilla in their own ways. So I was always very confident that we were going to win this thing, but it was just a question of when and how we would get the opportunity to do it. A couple of months ago, out of the blue, a very highly qualified geneticist contacted me. He said his wife had heard about it, told him about it, and he's a very courageous man. And he said, you know, I'd really like to know what this is. I think that with the new techniques that are available, I don't have access to the 454 technology that would allow for the full recovery of all of your genome. But what I can provide for you is what's called a shotgunning technique. And if you give me a sample, I can tell you if your nuclear DNA is in there. Mm-hmm. Because from where it was in 2003, now we can take much smaller samples. We can take samples of 200, 300, 400 base pairs long instead of the many hundreds or low thousands that you had to have in 2003. And he says if your sample is really unusual, and if there is, you know, something very unique about it, the smaller pieces should be able to tell us something. Mm. And I said, absolutely. I would love to have this kind of information, even if it means the whole thing's over with and there is no recovery of the nuclear DNA. I believe there will be. He said, well, I should be able to tell you. So we gave him. Go ahead.
So he did it out of curiosity primarily? He wanted to know as well?
Out of curiosity and just the true scientific spirit. Yeah. I mean, that's basically it. The true scientific spirit can be found in about 1 in 10 or 1 in 20 of actual real scientists. The rest of them are just basically cowards who don't want to risk the letting their peers know what they're doing. Mm. And I have to say this. Our guy is the same way in that he said, you can't announce who I am or where I work or anything like that, because I would lose my job immediately mm-hmm. if they knew that I was working on this in my spare time. But he says, if we get an answer that's a really robust and solid and provable answer, then of course we can come forward, because, you know, it'll be making history, it'll be a big deal and all that. So I said, okay, you've got my word on that. So he went to work, we gave him a sample and he went to work on it. And about 3 weeks later, Henrik, this was so cool, I got an email from him, and this is what it said. Hang on, Dorothy. We're not in Kansas anymore. And, you know, remember from The Wizard of Oz?
Oh, yeah.
It was like he had been swept up in a tornado. And he said, here's what we have. He says, I have now recovered several samples in the 200 to 500 base pair range. Your nuclear DNA is here. It is clearly here. Mm. But, he says, when I ran it through the National Institute of Health, the NIH database, I got some very unusual results. Now, let me explain what the NIH database is. Mm. Here in the States, we have a government institution called the National Institute of Health, the NIH, and what they do is they provide the money to many, many, many scientists in the country who are working on recovering genomes of different species. Now that they have the 454 machines and the technology to do it, those machines are running night and day recovering the genomes of every kind of species you can think of. So anytime public money is used, those genomes become public. And so they are put into the NIH database, which now contains billions and billions, if not trillions, of base pair chains from all these species. Now we're talking about from viruses to bacteria, to molds, to fungus, mm-hmm. to crustaceans, to mollusks, to fish, to primates, right on up. Everything is in there, 120 plus. Now, that's not every species on Earth, but it's samples of pretty much every species type.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so he ran those base pairs through the database, and he found that several of them found corollaries in human DNA it can even narrow it down to a certain segment of the first chromosome of humans. So clearly part of the Star Child's nuclear DNA is human. But to his great surprise, and to ours and everybody else's, some of the other parts, 300, 400 base pairs long, they were not just non-human, Henry. They were not just non-human. They are not found on Earth.
Okay.
Not anywhere in the NIH database. Mm. So that means this DNA that the Star Child carries, a good portion of it, is something that's never been seen on this planet before.
Hmm.
Now, that guarantees you. It guarantees you that the Star Child is indeed a human-alien hybrid. And it opens up an incredible, incredible vista of challenge for how to figure out what this thing is and what it, you know, what it might mean to all of us. You know, it's just, it's so exciting, and we just don't even hardly know where to begin to imagine where this kind of information is going to lead. So we're just, you know, we're pretty much flabbergasted, but we're sharing the word as we can within the alternative community. We're not putting it out onto the mainstream yet. We're not standing up in front of a press conference in front of the world, because the geneticist has to repeat what he's done several times so that and get, you know, longer chains and do a number of other things. He has to approach it from a variety of ways to make sure that critics aren't going to do like they did in 203. Now, let's go back to 203 and imagine. Here we have a recovery of mitochondrial DNA, a fresh, obvious, on the first attempt to recover, bright and clear in the gel sheets, obvious to anyone that this is not degraded DNA. This is good quality DNA. Understand now, remember, they're getting DNA out of fossils of Neanderthals and other creatures 30,000 years old and beyond. Mm. They're pulling nuclear DNA chips and pieces out of that. So it was clear in 2003 that we had good quality DNA. And in six attempts, we couldn't recover the nuclear DNA. That meant for sure that the father was the problem and the father was not human, or it would have recovered. Mm. So science would not accept that. They took the easy answer for them. You know, if they were scientists, if they were real true scientists, they would say, hey, wow, we're going to really look into this and try to find out what this is.
Yeah.
But no. This is not an answer science wants. This is not something science wants to deal with. This is something that's going to have to be crammed down its throat unwillingly at first. Mm. But once they're free to explore the possibilities here, once it's established firmly, then they will be in line begging for pieces of the sample to work with. You know how it's going to work. But for, until we can get to that tipping point where they're forced to acknowledge alien existence, which they don't want to deal with if, until they have to, we're just stuck. So he has to be very careful, our geneticist does, to make sure he's got everything lined up so that he can defend it against the assault of those among the scientific community who are going to be dedicated to preserving the status quo as it is. So we know that we're in for a dogfight, and we know that he has to be very, very careful about the time that he's able to stand on that stage and hold, you know, deal with the criticism that's going to come. Now, that could be 6 weeks from now, a couple months from now. We're not really sure. He's working on it as we speak, but because he has to use, he can use only the shotgun technique because he doesn't have access to a 454 machine. He has, it's going to go very slowly, unfortunately. Now, we're in the process, I am in the process of now trying to find investors who will now put the money into this, because we know we're going to have success. So that's what we're doing. Now, it's not just the scientific testing alone anymore. It's the recovery, is the explanation of what this new stuff is. It's going to be much more extensive, much more expensive. We have to film all of it. That's going to be much more expensive now because it'll be longer. And then we have to create a documentary film of this to pay for the investment. Mm. So we've got a good deal set up. We're just now starting to put it out in front of people over here. So we're confident that the money will come. It's a few million dollars, but it'll be paid back easily enough. And once we have that underway, then he can have access to a 454 machine. And once he has that, instead of recovering this thing in bits and pieces 2 and 3 and 4 and 500 base pairs long, he can recover, get this, 1 million base pairs at a run. Those 454 machines will recover 1 million base pairs at a run. And so what that means is he can have the whole genome, all 3 billion base pairs, within 2 months. literally, within 2 months. So once he has that, then they've got to figure out what it all means, because half of it is going to be, well, not necessarily half of it, but a lot of it is going to be unknown stuff, and they're going to have to figure out how it relates to human, and it's just going to be a fascinating study. Just one of the great, great events in scientific history is coming down the pipe here, and the people who are listening to me now on your show and the other few shows that I've done and who follow on my mailing list and you know, you're now the insiders. You now have an inside track on everybody out there, because until we step on the world stage to begin the process of forcing it down the throat of science, they're going to just ignore it and pretend it isn't existing. So
right.
They're in their last few weeks of just blissful ignorance about all this. But, you know, it's the snowball is rolling, really, Hendrik. I don't see how it can be turned around now. We're very excited, and we've just got to keep putting one foot in front of the other until we turn the corner, whenever that is, and everybody will then know about it around the world. It'll be a really, really big story.
So what could or what would, do you think, some of the criticism be if we look at the base pair numbers again? I mean, how many have you been able to recover now, and what would be a robust answer then for you in terms of the number of base pairs that your scientist can find for you?
Well, he would like to find just what he needs more than anything, Hendrik, is just repetition. He needs to find the same thing over and over again. See, that's what science is all about. One of the things that scientists respect the most about DNA is that it's the math of biology. Mm-hmm. You know, in math, you say 2 + 2 = 4. Well, okay, this time 2 + 2 = 4, but the next time maybe not. So you do it again, and you say, okay, 2 + 2 = 4. Well, okay, that's pretty impressive, twice in a row. You do 2 + 2 = 4 5 or 6 times. It's pretty doggone hard to argue that the next time you do it, it's not going to be 4. You see what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
So we have to. There has to be repetition. There has to be redundancy, so that nobody can say, "Oh, well, you just did it once. That doesn't mean that the next time it's not going to be something else. That you haven't made some kind of mistake. That you haven't misinterpreted it." So you have to show a sequence of testing such that the same equation is going together, the same parts go together, the same chemicals go together with the same batch of DNA, and the same results come out. And then it's fairly impressive, and it's going to be pretty hard to argue with. But even then, as the geneticist said, we can't even right now anticipate the arguments that the really smart ones among them are going to come up with. Mm-hmm. And they will come up with any kind of ridiculous thing you can imagine. And just because it might be possible that this thing could have happened, then that science is going to stand pat on that and say, okay, this is because it might be this crazy thing. This is enough for us to say we're going to put this on tentative, and it might not be true. Like, for example, when I would discover things in the physiology of the star child, let's just look at the bone, for example. Now, the bone of the star child is half as thick as it ought to be uniformly around the skull. It weighs half as much as it ought to weigh. It's 2 or 3 times as hard because it's not chemically like human bone. Mm-hmm. It's chemically like tooth enamel. And woven through the bone of the star child skull are fibers, unknown fibers, durable fibers that are not found in any other animal in the world that anybody knows about. Now, that's 4 things, 4 major colossal differences in the bone of the star child compared to human. Does that impress scientists? No.
No.
You know why? Because they say, well, nature can do anything. That's just a combination effect of differences, of deformities,
mutations,
of quirks, of
random chance. Yeah.
Exactly. So science's answer to everything physiological, everything that I came up with, was nature can do anything.
Mm.
All right. The one place they can't apply that to is DNA, because Nature can't fool with DNA because it's math. It's the math of biology. And if we consistently produce results that are not found in the NIH database, some scientists will say, well, just because it hasn't been found, every species on planet Earth has not yet been sequenced, so we're going to assume it's going to be found in one of those. And that will be some of their answer. But the reality of it is that if we can show this, people are going to know, the majority of people are going to know that this really is alien DNA. And as you probably know, in poll after poll around the world, about 50% of people already believe in the reality of UFOs and aliens. So we've got a built-in audience there hoping for proof. And I think that we will be able to provide it with this to a level that the average person and even the average scientist is going to believe in. But now let's be clear on how science undergoes major, profound change. Mm-hmm. Always, in every example that anybody can come up with, the reigning bosses of science at the time, those who are in charge, those who are the leaders of the field, they will not accept the new thing.
No.
They can't afford to accept the new thing. They have to die out, literally, physically be planted in the ground before the new, younger generation can come up, and those are going to be accustomed to it. Those are going to be able to wrap their minds around it, and it for them, it will just be a new reality that they have to deal with, and they have to find ways to incorporate into their worldview. So that's just the way it works. So there are going to be what they call the diehards. That's where the term, one of the areas that it's applied best. The diehard group of scientists are just never going to accept it. They can't afford to, because it so profoundly distorts their own worldview.
Yeah.
But the new generation, they'll jump on it. Young kids coming out of grad school, young guys just young women, men and women getting going in their careers. They will see it as, okay, we have to accept this, and what do we do with this? How do we make use of this? How do we incorporate this into what we know? And the reason, let's also understand that the reason science resists the idea of alien life and of hominoids, for that matter, this is the reality of Bigfoot, Yeti, and all of those creatures that live around the world. The reason science resists both of those is simple. It's going to absolutely stop the idea of human evolution dead in its tracks. It's basically going to kill the idea of evolution, at least as it applies to humans. But if you take away human evolution, you're very quickly going to take away the idea of evolution of domesticated plants and animals. And before you know it, science is going to have to look to accepting the ideas of Zechariah Sitchin and myself in my book, Everything You Know Is Wrong, and other people who write about what the Sumerians wrote 5,000 years ago about gods with a small g, aliens coming to live on Earth and deciding to create humans as their slaves and servants around 200,000 years ago. Now, this takes our conversation completely in another direction, so I only just want to mention that, because that when people say to me, why are scientists the way they are? Why won't they be scientists when it comes to these kinds of questions? And it's because it's going to take away one of their fundamental belief systems, and it's going to open the door up to more argument than they already have to deal with from creationists. Now, the great thing about this is it takes creationists out of the equation too. It creates a whole third argument, which is the intervention theory, which I promote, and it goes back to Eric von Daniken, that we're here because super beings came on Earth and put us here. And the evidence for that is really strong, very, very positive in many, many ways. And science doesn't want to deal with that. Science doesn't want to deal with that. Government doesn't want to deal with that. Religion doesn't want to deal with that. It changes the world as everybody understands it in what is now a very frightening kind of way. But, you know, it's the truth. And the truth, until we start dealing with the truth, how can we actually move forward toward our ultimate destiny, whatever that is, until we understand and acknowledge where we really came from?
I agree.
And how we might create a better existence for ourselves if we acknowledge these truths. Because, you know, let's face it, if we grow up to that point, maybe that's what the aliens, white people say to me also, why don't the aliens just come out and say, we're here and we're watching over you and we're experimenting on you and we're doing all these things. And if you want to live better lives, here's what you need to do. We need help. We're not a well put together species, mentally, emotionally, psychologically. We've got problems collectively and individually. Maybe there's a way that could be fixed or at least ameliorated and made better. None of that, I don't think, is going to happen until we are mature enough to acknowledge who they are and who we are. Mm-hmm. And so I think this is a real big, giant step in the direction of all humanity moving toward its true destiny. But we can't take those first steps until we acknowledge who we are and where we came from. And I think this Star Child research is going to force that issue. And I think in the end, it's going to be great for all of us.
So what if we talk about like your timeline expectations? How do you think this will unfold if we first look at it from the point of view, if everything goes as you expect it versus if things go totally the opposite way, problems... sticks in the wheel, et cetera. What's your timeline expectations on all this, Lloyd?
Well, the first thing we have to do, and it's a good question, the first thing we have to do really is get the money so that we can get our geneticist working on a 454 machine, get the whole thing underway, basically, so that he can start recovering whole huge chunks of the genome and put the whole thing together in a couple of months. So if we can get the money that we need, which is, again, a few million dollars, I mean, it doesn't grow on trees, but now that we have this, though, Hendrik, now that we have such a tremendous history-making deal and the movie, the documentary that will come out of this will be one of the most important documentaries ever made, so you know that it's going to make its money back and then some. So it's a good investment, it's a sound investment, and I think that we shouldn't have to wait more than a few weeks to find that person. And once we have that, then in very short order, we can get our guy working on a 454 machine. And once he can do that, then we have a couple of months before completion, and then a 2 or 3 months of initial analysis of the results should give us enough information to where we can have some completion in terms of the documentary. Here is where we know this is going to go. So I would say that everything could be wrapped up and done, and you could be looking at the film maybe even by the end of this year. I know that seems fast,
but if you
look at where things are right now, and actually that's a lot slower than we thought when we thought it was just going to be a smaller percentage of difference. Now that we know that it's going to be much larger, again, based on the percentage of the recovery of the initial recovery, which was about half and half, he said that won't necessarily hold up, but if it's anything like that, it's going to be an awful lot of work involved in in interpreting those unknown strings that are not recognized yet in the NIH database. And really what it amounts to is just putting them into the database, but you have to figure out what they are, where the stop-start codons are. There's a lot of things that go into figuring out what you have. So building them into genes and chromosomes and all that, it's a complicated thing. It's going to require other people besides our guy. So it's going to be an expensive proposition, well over $1 million just to do that part of it. But still, it's exciting. It can be done. It will be done. Everything is in place really right now except the money.
I see.
Everything is really in place except money. So we're pressing forward with that as hard as we can.
And, timelines in terms of new technology as well. I think, let's see here, was it a couple of days ago and I uploaded an article here where J. Craig Venter and all the guys who were behind the human, decoding the human genome back in around 2000, 2001, right. also talked about basically development of new computer systems as from their point of view to help them decode all the data. They have, as you said, Lloyd, they have tons amount of data out there to kind of decode and put everything to piece this big genetic puzzle together, so to speak. And I think that from their point of view, it's really going to lie with the future of computing, not the future of genomics as such, but it has to do with the computers.
That's exactly right. That is exactly what our guy said. He said, the problem here is not recovering the base pairs. That's a done deal yeah. with the 454. Whatever those base pairs are, see, that's the beauty of the. That's why in 2003 we could not get a recovery of the nuclear DNA, because the base pair strings that were put into the solution were human only human DNA. And because we knew the mother was human, so you didn't have to put chimp in, you didn't have to put gorilla in, you had to put base pairs designed to recover only human nuclear DNA. And it couldn't be done because the father's DNA is so incredibly different. Mm. So now we can recover all of his base pairs, but the arrangement of those base pairs, and really we're only talking about four, there are four base pairs, that's all. All of life is made up of four base pairs, four nucleotides. So those four are going to be in arrangements that have never been seen before. So it's the computers, exactly that, the computing that's going to have to figure out what those combinations are and how they compare and how they differ with what's already in the human genome. So it's all doable, and I did not know that there had been a step forward in that, but there's step forwards all the time in all of technology like this. But our geneticist was very clear that once the recovery is made, specialists who do that analysis with the computers are going to have to be brought in to interpret what we have.
Yeah.
So it's all part of the process, but I asked him the same question, the timeline question, and he said if everything were to go right, if within a matter of a few weeks, if let's say by the end of April, by the start of May, we had the money, we know we're full speed ahead, we can start hiring people, get the 454 machine lease, do the whole everything we have to do, then by the end of the year, most of it can be done, if not all of it. And, you know, maybe have the film out by Christmas or something like that. Very, very exciting stuff.
That's very, very promising. And maybe as a side note here, I don't know, Lloyd, in terms of connections between the apes and modern human or the Homo habilis species here. From the Telegraph here a couple of days ago now, they came out with a new article which claims that they're going to unveil another one of these missing links now in the coming week here. I don't know if you heard about this yet, but
yeah, I did. In fact, I talked about that briefly on a big radio show that we have here called Coast to Coast last night.
Right.
Yes, I did. And in fact, we put something up on my Lloyd Pye website last night. If anybody listening wants to see a brief analysis of this, you know, what's going to be a huge story come Thursday when they release it, if you want to see a very brief analysis that I think will help you understand what it's supposed to be, go to www.lloydpye.com, and right there on the front page you will see a photo of a drawing of a human being with a gorilla face, a chimp face melded into it. It's like two stuck together. It's very arresting. And click on that link and it will take you over, and what you will see is a down looking view of a typical Australopithecus skull and a typical early Homo skull, Homo habilis, Homo erectus, like that. These are all considered to be pre-humans. And one of the great mysteries of anthropology, the evolution, they call it, of anthropology, is how did they go from the Australopithecines to the early Homos? Because they're very different. And as you'll see on that page, again, lloydpye.com, and click over, on the link that you see there. It's such a huge difference, and there's no transitions between them. It just, you have the one, and then you have the other, and there's such a big gap. So they've always needed a missing link there. In the same way, they've needed a missing link between Neanderthals and Cro-Magnons. When they say missing link, that's what they're talking about, between Neanderthals and Cro-Magnons, because the difference between a Neanderthal and a Cro-Magnon is every bit as big as the difference between the Australopithecines and the early Homos. So it's like, how did it happen? How could it have evolved? How could it be a result of evolution, of gradual evolution, when you have one type of creature and then suddenly you have another type of creature that is vastly different? Mm. It's not a transition that evolution calls for. It's a transformation. And the same thing happens again when you go from the pre-humans up through the Neanderthals to Cro-Magnons, which are early humans. You have another of those transformations. So what they're trying to say about this new discovery is that it's going to fit in between the two. So if you look on the link that we have there, we put a little grayed out thing saying, you know, is this going to fit in here? Is this going to actually be something that shows attributes of both? And it remains to be seen, because none of us have seen a picture, you know, pictures of it yet. Mm-hmm. But for those of you who are listening and who might want to check that out, all of this kind of stuff about human origins is discussed in my book, Everything You Know Is Wrong, which is, you know, easy enough to get, I think, on Amazon.co.uk. Are in the States through iUniverse.com, but that's where I talk about all of this, and I'm just as strong on these human origin issues as I am on the Star Child. These are all things that science needs to address, needs to deal with, but don't want to, because it's going to cost them the precious to them idea that humans evolved on Earth along with everything else, which is patently not true, which is obviously not true. And there is a lot of evidence to indicate that we are a genetically engineered species that was put here only about 200,000 years ago. Mm. And that's what my book, Everything You Know Is Wrong, is all about. But I'm not the only one who says this. You know, the work of von Däniken and Zechariah Sitchin and many others. Mm. But people, if they're not aware of these ideas, should make themselves aware of them, because they're absolutely fascinating. If you're into alternative knowledge, to me, there's nothing more interesting and nothing more fact-based and defensible than this theory of intervention theory.
Exactly, absolutely. And so that'll be exciting in a moment as well, Hunter, later in the week here, then on about Thursday, when they announce this stuff and see what they whip up there and see if there's any validity to it. What do you expect? Will it be another, you know, just another Lucy, so to speak, or what do you think they will look
like?
Yeah,
it's going to be, what I understand is it's as complete as Lucy, if not more so. It's a very complete child skeleton. Mm. And I really don't know what they're going to say and how they're going to spin it to make it look human. They always do everything they can to shoehorn those pre-humans like Lucy and like the Lake Turkana boy and like everything up through Neanderthals. They do their best to make them seem like incipient humans, because it's important for those creatures to appear in the minds of ordinary people to be humans, even though every physical attribute of them is not human except the fact that they walk upright. If you take away the upright walking part of it, and you've got upright walking chimps. Everything about those creatures, and that goes right through Neanderthal, is chimp-like. It's primate-like. Mm-hmm. They are upright walking primates, and they are almost certain to be as hair covered as primates are. In other words, they're hominoids. That's what one of the major parts of my book is, Everything You Know Is Wrong, is about hominoids, which are, you know, again, Bigfoot, Yeti, and most people don't understand that they're, instead of those two types that everybody knows about, there are actually four types around the world. And you remember last week, the big discussion was about a finger bone that they had found in Russia. Mm-hmm. And its mitochondrial DNA was unlike both human DNA and Neanderthal mitochondrial DNA. Now, what they're saying, what science is saying, well, then that means we've got ourselves another human, just like the Hobbit. Mm. You know, Hobbit, well, even though it doesn't look a thing like a human being, except it walked upright, it's another type of human being. Even though it looks like a chimp, even though it looks like Lucy, we're going to have to call it a human because it was walking upright, and it was 17,000 years ago, so that's got to be another kind of human. This one, 30,000 years ago, and so they're saying, well, okay, if it's upright, it's 30,000 years ago. I don't care how different it is from humans and Neanderthals. It's got to be another kind of human. They will do anything to keep from saying, well, maybe it's a hominoid. You know, maybe it's one of these creatures that people talk about and describe going back hundreds of years and all that. Look, Russia is the center of the third kind, which is called the Almas, A-L-M-A-S, the Almas, or the Almasti, and are the Kaptar. They have other names for them, like we have multiple names, and every place in the world that has these creatures has their localized name for them. But the Almas, that's a finger bone of an Alma. You can bet it is. Mm. But they're not going to, science is never going to allow that until the same way we have now the opportunity to cram the Star Child down their throat and to resolve the alien UFO issue, there will one day be a capture or a killing of a real true hominoid, and that will cram that down their throats. Hmm. But eventually, science is looking at two major avenues of destruction of the evolutionary theory, and that especially as it applies to humans. And that is UFOs and aliens and hominoids. And both of those have the potential to take it down any single day that comes up. And we're working hard to see that the day is going to come now where we're going to stand on the world stage and take it down with the Star Child's DNA. And someone else someday is going to do that with a hominoid as well. It's just a matter of where and when.
All right, Lloyd Pye, thank you so much for sharing some of this update information. Very exciting. Again, the website is lloydpye.com. And don't forget to check out that article then as well, Missing Link Found Again. And we'll see what the Telegraph and all the other news agencies whip up here in terms of this new discovery, so to speak. Go ahead.
And also mention the StarChildProject.com as well.
Absolutely. Absolutely. StarChildProject.com. That's the site to go to specifically get more information about the Star Child Project alone. Is there anything else you'd like to mention as a closing?
For those who want to educate themselves really quickly about the Star Child, I can recommend the Star Child ebook. It's called Star Child Skull Essentials. It's very inexpensive. It's $10. Almost anybody can afford that. It's a quick and easy download, and it's 125 illustrations with text boxes. It's very easy to read. It's very comprehensive. It gives you all the main facts that you can use to discuss this with people that you might want to tell about it, and it will make you the smartest person in the room when it comes to discussing UFOs or aliens if ever you find yourself in that kind of a situation. So there's also a real book called The Star Child Skull, which tells you the whole backstory of how the information came to be, and you're certainly free to get that as well. But I just want people to make themselves aware of the information as best they can. An educated populace is well informed and helps our cause all along the way. So we just want to get the information out as quickly and as widely as we can.
Keep up the great work, Lloyd. Godspeed to you and your team. And we hope to have you back, obviously, with a definitive answer on the Star Child, and that more and more will reveal itself here down the line here, Lloyd, then.
Absolutely. I'll let you guys know when we know.
Oh, awesome. Thank you so much for coming on, Lloyd.
The pressure of the morning, I keep forgetting the smell of the warm summer air. I live in a town where you can't smell a thing. You watch your feet for cracks in the pavement. Up above, aliens hover, making home movies for the folks back home. Of all these weird creatures who lock up their spirits, draw holes in themselves, I live for the sea. beautiful ship, showing the world as I love to see.
Our update from Lloyd Pye with the latest on the Star Child Skull. Follow us at redicecreations.com, radio, TV, videos, and much more. Check out our members area if you want full access to our archives and support Red Ice. We'll be back with more radio soon. Check out our radio archive for upcoming guests. My thanks to Fredrik, Elizabeth, and Lana. Bye bye for now. We'll talk more later.